All right, tonight we're going to be continuing in our series. Okay. We're going to be continuing in our series of Kosher Mishpat Shiurim. In this time, we're going to take a break for a couple of weeks after this. Next week, God willing, we will have a Pesach Shiur, and the following week, God willing, we will have a Haggadah Shiur, and the Haggadah itself, as we did last year, and those who want multiple Hortlach and Haggadah, more than we're able to say in a one-hour Shiur, you can go on the website and get last year's Hortlach as well. And it will be all new this year, nothing to do from last year. And then the following week after that is going to be like non-disrespectful Pesach, and we'll cancel the show that week. It's not going to be shy from that thing. Based on past experience, I don't think it's going to be shy from baby for Pesach and baby for Pesach to have the show that week. So, and then the show after Pesach, we'll see. We'll try to continue maybe a little bit with the Hoshim Mishpat Shiurim. And again, I invite suggestions of topics in terms of social media topics. It's all new to me, and it's all doing the research from scratch anyway, so I'm certainly open to any sorts of topics. One topic I get asked about a lot, but much more so in yeshiva than I do here, is the topic of copyright laws. Meaning, in general, when you think of stealing, you don't think of, we think of stealing something tangible. And the very notion that there could be such a thing as stealing an idea from somebody else, or stealing what's called intellectual property from somebody else, is very difficult to get a handle on. Meaning, it's not exactly stealing. Like, let's say someone prints a book, and I go ahead. So we have a Rebbe in Yeshiva who assigns a machshava paper to the boys every year, and the 12th-day boys have to present some sort of original paper on some type of machshava topic, Jewish thought topic that they've researched. And every year, he'll find a phrase or two that looks like it couldn't have been written by a 12th grader, and he'll Google the phrase, and then he'll get the whole paper, he'll find the whole thing that was presented. So on the one hand, the kid will say, well, I didn't steal the paper, I didn't steal the ink, he didn't steal anything tangible, but he just put some of, he caught one of the kids, he did the research, he Googled whatever the topic was, and he found it. But, the best stories are, just a little bit of an aside, he got one kid he caught, who actually said, and I was talking to my wife the other day, and the other one is calling for a story about his grandfather that he just couldn't believe that it was just his grandfather and granddad, it was whoever he got the paper from. So that's the issue. To what extent is that problematic? And obviously, much more practically, for us, certainly those who are into music, I know the big guy of a close friend who's very big on the Jewish music scene, and it's one of the biggest battles that they fight now, that the cost of producing an album is becoming prohibitive because the amount of sales is always going to be down, no matter how good the music is, and no matter how many people are listening to it, because people will just put it on their iPods and send it to somebody else, and I don't even know how it all works, but it's very easy electronically to just send the music from one person to the other, and no one ends up buying the actual CDs or the actual music the way it's sold. Now, in the same with the non-Jewish music, it's very easy to get on the, you could pay for it on the internet for a nominal fee in the Apple, get it onto your iPod, but in the Jewish music world, people want to listen to it on their iPod. So to what extent do we say that it's okay or not okay to be stealing the music, even though you paid for the CD, but you're then using it to reproduce multiple times. And obviously the most practical example we have that we always come up with is computer programs. Right? If someone buys a new computer and they say, it didn't come with Microsoft Word or whatever. So someone goes, don't worry, I have the disk. I'll just give you the disk. And it's very easy. You just type in your number and the computer program gets loaded onto the computer. But Microsoft sold the program not to you, to the other person, and it says very clearly in the copyright that you're not supposed to reproduce it or reuse it. In fact, in many of the computer programs, if I'm not mistaken, they say that you can't even use it on two computers. I mean, even if I own two computers, and I want to put, let's say I have a program that I want to have on both of my computers, which most programs I would want to have on both of my computers, obviously, so it says that you're not allowed to put it on both. A friend of mine, when he bought one of the Hebrew word processing programs, called up the company, and he said, look, I have two computers, I use them interchangeably, can I please just take the program, can I get permission, take the program and load it on both computers? And they said, no, you can't do it, you can never reproduce it, ever, we're losing money off of this type of thing, and you can't do it. So the question is, so to what extent do we say that's unreasonable already, and to what extent is it reasonable to expect a person not to start handing out computer programs? So It's interesting that in the halakhic literature on this topic, and I will confess at the beginning, I don't really have a very strong grasp on exact, you know, I haven't put my finger on every single issue over here, but I looked around a little bit in the contemporary scholar, and we'll basically, you'll see it's a big package, because there's a lot of literature, and I didn't really have time to whittle it down to smaller pieces, but we'll try to go through and try to learn a little bit some of the major sources. And all the Svarim, the general topics were not with music and not with computer programs, obviously, but over the past few hundred years, the topic being discussed was using Svarim. It was reprinting Svarim, reprinting materials that other people had written or that a certain publisher had the right to publish, and you publish it in a slightly different way, is to what extent that, right, these very normal publishers are shadowing, right? Can I hand out my almost like this? So certainly, the ones that I get from the Bar Ilan TV, so that's the very purpose of the Bar Ilan TV. I'm sure they pay good money to be able to use it with the understanding that the users of the Bar Ilan TV are going to cut and paste the small Maramakomos. But there are some Maramakomos that the Bar Ilan TV does not yet have. You'll see source number 11, some others, that I actually have to do the old-fashioned cutting and photocopying, then cutting and pasting onto the onto the paper. So to what extent is that mutter or usher? There's a Rebbe in Yeshiva where I teach who, whenever he photocopies anything for the boys, he gives them the oldest printing in the world. He can barely read it. The letters are tiny, it's all about his script. There are a million typos, and these farmers have been republished dozens of times since then, but he won't photocopy it. Because he just doesn't want to mess around with the copyright law. He doesn't want to have even a shot gazelle, so he gives the old one cut clean up, you know, the old one, right? The old part they could barely read. And the kids have a hard enough time reading as it is. Now they have to, right, so the old copyrights is fine, right. So that's why he won't use any of the new spars, because the copyrights are still in effect. So that's the issue. To you know, it sounds like a lot of questions, but it's really only one question. Meaning, one or two questions. It's really just does halacha recognize copyright laws, or even I say copyright laws. We actually have copyright laws in the sense. Let's say someone didn't get a copyright. Someone just didn't get a patent on something. They had an invention, an idea, and they never got a patent on it. So good, in American law, it's their problem, they never copyrighted, they never got a patent on it, you can go ahead and do as you please with the idea. But but when it comes to halakha, does halakha allow you to do that? Meaning, does halakha, even if halakha requires you to honor copyright law, is that only because you have to honor all the laws? Or is it a special din, that there's some sort of halakha that you're not allowed to steal somebody's idea? That if the person invested time and effort and money into an idea, then you're not allowed to go ahead and steal the idea. Right?
Well, what happens if they didn't register as copyright, but they just had an idea? So American law doesn't apply.
Right, that's what I'm saying. So in a case where American law doesn't apply, what does halakha say? Does halakha say, if American law doesn't apply, you're on your own, or does halakha still have certain strict certain limitations of what you are and are not allowed to do? So just some basic background, just to give us a flavor of the Torah Hashkafa on the topic of using other people's ideas and passing them off as your own, or even not passing them off as your own. So there's a famous Mishnah, Masechet Avos. The Mishnah tells us, right after Purim here, it says, Ha'omer davar d'shem omro, Ha'omer davar d'shem omro, the Mishnah says, maybe ku'ulo li'olam. If you cite something from its source and you quote it from where you got it, so that brings Geula into the world. It's a very positive thing to do. How do we know? Shenamar, like Esther and Malchus did, what did Esther do? But Tomer Esther the Melech, Bishayim and Mordechai. When Esther told something to the Melech, she told it, Bishayim Mordechai. And that brought about the Geula, because it was Mordechai's name that got written in the book because Esther said it in the name of Mordechai. Because his name was in the book, the whole story was able to happen. The whole Geula from the terrible sorrow was able to happen. So we see that it's literally maybe Geula li'ola. And that's why we have the expression. It's not just some expression that we throw around. It literally brought about the Geula because someone was willing to give credit to somebody else. All we see from that source, though, is that it's a very good thing. We don't find an issue to nothing, we just find that it's a very good thing. In the Medrash Tanchuma, and this is Midrashim, this Medrash, this passage of the Medrash, comes up in a number of different Midrashim, by the way, I just got the one from Medrash Tanchuma on Parshas Bamidbar, that's, Kol mi she'eino omer davar mishal Torah b'shem omro, on the second line, anyone who doesn't say something in the name of he who got it from, shalav l'akot of omer, al tigzol, he doesn't, though. You shouldn't rob from the poor. So over here you have already the negative side. You go ahead and you say something without citing where it's from, so then it's considered that you're stealing from someone who is poor. That's the first time we have stealing an idea is being referred to as stealing. This is a discussion some of the contemporaries, Dr. Tzina Rav has a shaila in one of his, in the Be'er Moshe, the shaila of Shulchan Be'er Moshe, where someone said, if you learn Shulchan Aruch, and on the bottom of the Shulchan Aruch is a Pesukei Teshuva, and the way the Pesukei Teshuva works is the Pesukei Teshuva quotes all these other svarim, the Pesukei Teshuva, the Yudah says, what the Kamsofer says, what the Shulchan Levation says, we'll tell all the different svarim, all of which will be prominent in tonight's year, all the names that just mentioned happen to be Pesukei Teshuva as well. There's a big copyright discussion about his statement. Publication of his statement. But anyway, so all these different sort of recordings of Pesukei Teshuva. Are you allowed to say that Nozvidu says this? You didn't see it in Nozvidu. You saw it in the Pesukei Teshuva. You did it, you saw the Pesukei Teshuva quoted in Nozvidu. Is that a greater thought also, sort of? Is that a way of, is that something that's also passing off from someone else's idea? Pesukei Teshuva was the one who found the Nozvidu. You didn't find the Nozvidu. So are you not allowed to say, oh yeah, this is whatever, a discussion from there. So, he says if you look up another view, you can quote from another view, otherwise you can't. But again, this is just the broader, more general idea of quoting something that doesn't actually belong to you. Now, we pointed out in the daf a couple of times, there's a Magen Avraham in some Kuf Nun Vav who writes, based on a couple of Gemaras that we've learned, the Gemara in Erev and the Gemara in Pesach that we'll see later on, that if, let's say, I know a Pesach Halacha to be true. I know that it's 100% correct, but I also know that if I go around and I tell everyone that this Pesach Halacha, no one's going to care what I have to say. Because it's all mine. And we'll listen to some, young rabbi from North Woodmere, they'll listen to someone who's big. They're not going to listen to me anyway. But I'm so sure it's true, and I think the whole world is being nitshal or something, and I think it's terrible. So the Magen Avraham says, I'm allowed to go ahead and say, I heard from Moshe Feinstein that I never spoke to Moshe Feinstein. So, people will listen to it if I say I heard from Moshe Feinstein. So if people will listen to it, I'm sure that it's true, because there are Gemaras that indicate that you're allowed to do that. So that's interesting. That's already somehow an exception to the rule of not saying something that you heard from somebody, or saying something that, whatever, meaning saying something that you didn't hear from somebody, not saying something in the name of who you heard something from. That's already an exception to the rule. Now, when it comes to actual copying of Torah, so the Shach writes that if you give credit to somebody, so where you got it from, then you don't need permission even to copy Torah, meaning all this was about giving credit. And once I give credit, so I can say, this is the book of the, I could take, let's say, a popular sefer, I could say, okay, I'll put the author's name on the front, I'll publish it myself, and I'll sell it myself. I gave credit to who it was, I didn't claim that I wrote it, so yeah, it's fine, I can go ahead and give over that Torah, even though it's not actually my own Torah, as long as I quote it from somebody else. Now that already, exactly to what extent we're going to allow that, is obviously the topic of the shiur, and that's not just an all-out hesed that you can go and publish and make money and cost other people money, right? So that's going to be a question depending on circumstance. Is the sefer that I'm quoting from still available? Is the person still alive? Are his children still alive? Right? All of these things are going to be questions that we're going to have to ask. It's interesting that the Rashba writes, although the Shach writes rather the Shulchan Aruch writes, if you look in Shulchan Aruch in Choshen Mishpat, Simen Reish Tagidei Tzitzchak, in source number 7, the Ramah writes that a B'makum Bittul Torah She'in Svarim in Sayim, that sometimes a person has something, they have the ability to share an idea, that let's say a person says, I have a rabbi who has beautiful Divrei Torah. He writes those beautiful notes. He has amazing Divrei Torah that you want to share with everyone. But he says, don't share it. Right? So can you force him to share it? Meaning he's robbing everyone of all of this Torah. So the Ramah writes, not quite to that extent, but Ramah writes, Makom Bittul Torah She'in Svarim in Sayim. Let's say there's a place where there aren't that many Svarim available, and there is someone that has a very big library. Says the Ramah, Yecholim Bezim Lachos Echad Lahashil Svarim Lilmozahem. Man, that Bezin has the right to force somebody to make his Svarim available to the public. Meaning that Bezin has the right to say, you don't have the right to rob people of your Torah. And if you have Torah that you're able to give to them, so you have to give it to them. Obviously, if they're going to destroy the Svarim, they're going to have to pay for it. That goes without saying that there's an understanding that they're going to be responsible for whatever damage they do. But the Ramah says that you don't have a right to withhold Torah from people. So the Nitziv was asked the Shaila, to what extent do we take that? I have all these Svarim that other people don't have, so I don't have a right to say, no, I'm very particular about my Svarim, you can't use that. I know I have a bigger library than most, and therefore, if you need a particular Sefer, of course I'm going to lend it to you. I don't have a right to not lend it to you. Beis Din can force me to loan you the Sefer. But the Nitziv was asked, if you look at source number 8, while Dover Asher Asir Nalas Kvodu Nerea Ir, Das Aviv Hagod Vatsal, he says, I know your father Zechatzal of Rafa, whoever he's writing to, had an opinion, Shalo Lahatzis Chuvosav Asher Heshiv Halakha L'maisa. He was very careful, he didn't want to publish his chuvos that he wrote Halakha L'maisa to pass him for people. Right? Different rabbins do different things. Rav Moshe Feinstein published thousands of chuvos. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky answered many shaylos, never published a single chuvah. Right? Different people have why did Yaakov not publish a single chuvah? Because he was afraid. But I think that this person, some of the people would say that someone will come in to ask him a question, then someone else in the next day would ask him the same question, they get some different answers. Because the circumstances are slightly different. It's called the Shas Hat for that one, it's called the Shas Hat for the other one, and people will stretch the chuvahs and they'll mold the chuvahs to fit into whatever she does there. As we see, he's done with Rav Moshe's chuvahs every day, and we hope we assume that the tikkun of Rav Moshe's chuvahs far outweighs whatever pilkul people do, but people do that all the time. They adjust the chuvahs to fit their agenda. And it's not so difficult, because each case is only slightly different, and certain people are very hesitant to publish it. In fact, the Rav Moshe published his chuvahs, the Hatzama, to the first volume of Yiddish Moshe, is his letter explaining why apologizing almost for publishing his chuvahs. I know that I'm a nobody, and I know that I have no right, and I don't understand why anyone would be interested in reading my chuvahs in the first place, because you have all these other great chuvahs, you have all these previous generations. But, and he goes through and he explains why he thinks it's not such a terrible chutzpah for a little rabbi from the Lower East Side to Russia, not the Lower East Side, to publish his chuvah. So that's different hanagos that people have. So apparently, a son was asking a shayla to the Nasid that his father didn't want to ever publish his chuvah salat al-maisa. Mitam she'in lismos kol kak ala chuvah, Kimol al Mashakata Vidarat Limud also Limian. And he had a very strange thorough. Why didn't he want to publish the chuvahs? He said the chuvahs are not as deep and not as thorough as when I really go through a halakhic union, when I go through an issue in learning, when I say a shir on something, when I study with the Talmidim, I'm much more thorough when I do that. So my learning is much more publishable when I do that. But when I'm just answering the shayla, the maitza, so it's not as thorough and I'm not as happy. And certainly when I'm preparing a shir, I'm certainly going to be much more thorough than when someone just comes and asks me a shayla off the cuff and I have to give an answer. So I'll go through quickly in my mind what I need to know and try to answer the question correctly. Sometimes you look up in the sefer, but you don't prepare a whole shir on every shayla you're asked. There's a lot of shaylas. Hopefully you won't set a share in me, and then you have it, you know, well. But it's not always true. Sometimes you set a share in me, you forgot the next day. I haven't seen all the time. The son of Tavar of Amasha, Sima Apostim, Lismok of his Kerash, he says he had a raya. The father had a raya, why he shouldn't publish his tshuva, but the stuff that he said in learning is much better. Because he said, we know that the Apostim are masking that it's more correct to be somit. The Rush has a couple of Svarim. There's the Tshuva Sarash, and then there's the Rush that we know from the back of the Gemara. Which one do we see being quoted in the Big Sales Tape more often? Which one do we rely on Halakha L'maisa more often? Obviously, what the Rush writes is in the stairs in the back of the Gemara. The Tshuva Sarash, you'll see Tshuva Sarash quoted here and there, but it's not nearly as widely learned, or as widely respected for that matter, as the Pizkei Rush in the back of the Gemara. Why is that so? So this Talmud Chacham, the father of the Shoal, said it must be because what the Rush learning the Sefer was Derech Limud. He was learning the Sugya. He was completely Rosh Berugo into the Sugya. So what he came out with was something thorough and something clear. Chuvah Sarash, so I'm asking Hashem. He gave him a test. He gave him a chuvah. He gave him an answer. But he didn't actually go through it as clearly. The Simul Od, and he says a third reason why he doesn't want to publish the Shuvah, is Mashamu Chazal, Im Lemidin Halakha Mipi Maisa, because you can't learn halakha based on the Maisa Shahaya. Halakha has to be learned going back to the sources and beginning from the Gemara and going through all of the fundamental sources. So you can't just learn based on the Shiloh that was at halakha Maisa. That was the Shiloh posted in the Yehuda. Now, what's the Shiloh? The Shiloh is, the father's dead now. He didn't want his shoes to be published, but they're really good. And the king wanted to publish his shoes. His son wanted to publish his father's shoes. Is he allowed to do it, even though he knew full well that his father didn't want them published? So one reason, intuitively, you would say, honor the father's request. So yes, he wants to publish his shoes. He obviously wasn't comfortable with it. Honor his request. Right? I mean, what do you have to go ahead and do this for? Sometimes people aren't so comfortable. Sometimes people don't want to publish because they're not that confident, and sometimes it's not that good. Right? There are people who think, I know there's one particular very well-used paper on Malajan that was published posthumously from a very famous Machaber. I don't want to say the name of the paper, but it's from a very famous rabbi in Yerushalayim. And there are people who hate this paper because they say it's a bizayon to this rab. We read his tshuvos and they're fantastic and they're phenomenal. And then we read the paper. It's a little part here and there, and you can ask Kashas and you can argue on every piece he says. So it's a bizayon to have certain things published. That's what I would have said right off the bat. That this is what kind of chutzpah is it? Because I'll publish some of the tshuvos after he specifically requested that they not be published. But the Mitzvah doesn't think so. The Mitzvah takes each argument one by one. It says, first of all, where do you get such an idea that when what you say in the course of your learning is clearer than what you say in the course of a Pesach Halacha? It says, Adrabah, there's a certain siyata d'shmaya that you get when you pass Kana Halacha. Well, you need it. When you pass Kana Halacha, you have a certain, there are posts in where you go and you ask the Shiloh, can you say theoretically? And they say, it's theoretically, I'm not answering. Right, and the Postman will say that because they feel that they're not going to get the clarity that you get from a certain Siyata Dishmaya on the theoretical level that they would when answering Halakha L'maaseh. Yeah?
Turner said that the Torah is not yours, and therefore you don't have the ability to hold it back.
So. Right, so on the one hand, the Gemara does have a phrase that the Torah is Yilehu, that it is a person's Torah, let's say, Kamakakam Shemacho HaKavoda. Right, so we assume that when a person learns the Torah, he acquires the Torah, he becomes his. But the Nesuv says we take that too far. So the Nesuv sort of develops that idea a little bit. He says, when we say Torah delay, let's take it one short time. Because first of all, when he passed around Lachas, you have ultimate clarity. And he says, the thing from the Chumash Arash, not convinced by it at all. He says, you know why we listen to the Pisgei Arash more than the Chumash Arash? Not because of this general idea that Chumash are less authoritative than a parish on the Gemara. He says, no, the Rush's own sons told us that the Pisgei Arash are more authoritative. Why are they more authoritative? Because the Rush's children knew that the Rush wrote the Pisgei Arash after he wrote the Chumash Arash. Most of them were written when the Rush was a little bit older. Most of the Pisgei Arash were written when the Rush was a little bit older than he was when he wrote the Chumash Arash. So if he ever changed his mind, chances are you're getting the later opinion in the Pisgei Arash. And if he changed his mind, the person has the right to change his mind. So why should you go? He wouldn't want you going by what he used to think. He wants to go in by what he thought at the end. So he's not at all convinced. He says it happens to be that people are hesitant to publish tshuvos, the Mitzvah says, but that's not because they think it's less authoritative, but it's just because of the Shil Shiyish Lusmuk al Tshuvos Biyoter, the Himlo Rosh Shiyish Lusmuk al Daitam. It's because the opposite reason. They know that everyone is so much on tshuvos, and they don't want to force people to listen to what their particular opinion is. That's why a lot of people don't publish tshuvos. But the Mitzvah says, developing Yehuda's point, the Mitzvah goes on to say that yes, your Torah becomes yours. However, your Torah becomes yours to the extent that you're required to share them with others, to share your Torah with others, and to give over your Torah to others. Now, to what extent do you have to give your Torah over to others? But you can choose who to give it over to, but you better give it to somebody. Meaning the Torah is meant to be learned. You're supposed to learn it in order to teach it to other people. You can choose who you're going to decide to give it to. But you have to give it to somebody. You can't say, no, none of it's good enough. I don't want to give it to anybody. What are you doing with all your time then? None of it's good enough. You want to be a giver. You want to be able to give Torah over. And it's not only for Rabbanim. Like, speak to Baal Batim, who gives Kaburas and Shirim. And it's a very gratifying experience to be able to learn the Sugya well and to be able to give Torah over. Right? We all feel it at the Pesach Seder or whatever. Whatever context we're able to do it in, it's a very important experience of being a Jew. To be able to give to give you the tone of, it's a plug for Shalom Shudas when we start the Shalom Shudas. Right? So it's an important experience for a person to have. So the Nitziv says, the guy didn't want to publish Shudas. He said, nah, there's no such thing. He had these wonderful Shudas, he published the Shudas. And the Nitziv thought that you can violate his will. Now, obviously, just to, I think it's clear without me saying, but obviously that doesn't mean you can publish somebody else. This is a family member publishing his father's shuvos, and he's not like he's not benefiting at somebody else's expense. It's not a case where you have some rabbi that you know is alive and publishes and teaches a lot, that there's a certain notebook that he's not comfortable with publishing, so break into his house and steal the notebook and publish it is obviously not allowed, right? It's been done, but it's not allowed. I'm sure I mentioned at some point, right? There's a guy who published out of Schechter's notes on the Rav Shirin on Secretary's Full and Mezuzah, I think, in Hokistan. And he just sold the notebook and he published it as his own. He didn't check his name anywhere. And it's just Shirin from Salvation, nothing to do with where he got it from. And they published the whole thing. And as the greatest part of the story is that Schechter has a very curvy handwriting. So if you ever see, he writes whenever he adds an idea to the Rav's notes, he'll always write the idea, he'll add a few marmotomos in parentheses, and then write at the end, Dalid Ayin, because that docs me. That this isn't what the Rav said, this is what I said. This is my own addition. So he has a curvy handwriting, and the Dalid looks a little like a Tzad. So the person who published it spelled it out, and wrote the Tzarafian. Every single thing he said, it says the Tzarafian, and you don't know what the cash is, because it all makes sense. But it's always the Tzarafian at the end. There's another paper also on the market. This you can buy. That one you can't buy in the stores, because when they first published it, the viral listing scene went to all the stores in Meisharim and emptied them all out of the unlisted paper that they didn't, or just told them they can't sell. He has thousands of copies of that paper in his basement somewhere in the bush. But that paper is very hard to come. Remember, Mark Simon showed me a copy that he had it. He gave a shiur for me. But there's another paper that's much more available called Hamazbir, a different receptor. Beautiful Varlach, Hamazbir. So it tells you that this is what this Rishon says is, what that Rishon says is, what this Akram says is, and this is what the Mazgir says. Who's the Mazgir? Doesn't tell you what the Mazgir is. So what did the person do? Again, so Shechter goes from the Rav Shirin, Hamazgir backwards, Rav Yashar Ber Salvechik, right? Hamazgir, Rav Yashar Ber Salvechik, and they didn't want to cut Shon Kitz's name, because then the Yeshivish world won't buy it, and they didn't want to cut Shechter's name, because if you take credit to yourself, right? So they just published it. That's not allowed. That's not what the Nitziv is talking about. What he's talking about, the guy had all these shuvahs and he had these certain needs of hesitance to publish them for other reasons. His own children wanted to publish them, wanted to be mekarseh, the Torah of the Father. That's certainly a different story altogether. Okay, so that's just the basic back on the idea of reproducing something that doesn't belong to you. Now, the issue of commercial reproduction of Svarim is a two-sided issue. First of all, there's the stealing of somebody else's idea. Talmud Chacham writes the Sefer. Right? So it's his Kiddushi Torah. He worked hard on learning that Torah, and he published the Sefer, and he wrote the Sefer. So there's the Isser against the Talmud Chacham, perhaps, not that you're taking his idea, but there's also another issue, and that is there's a publisher of the Sefer, and the publisher makes money off the Sefer. The publishing houses need to stay in business, and they need people buying the books that they're publishing in order to stay in business. So it could be that, let's say I get the permission of the guy who wrote the book, but the publisher now has the right to publish the book, and someone else publishes it. So that could be that these are two completely different issues. Now, in terms of the publishing of the book, we'll deal with that one first. In terms of the publishing of the book, there's a famous Tshuvas HaRamah. Tshuvas HaRamah, when I first put on the Maror Makom, which is about 10 pages long, I tried to cut out half of it. I cut out more than half of it, and it's a lot shorter now. But the Tshuvas HaRamah deals with a printing of the Rambam. I think maybe in our Sabbath Kabbalah show we discussed this. The Rambam was printed by the Maharam Padova, spent a great deal of time working through all of the errors in the Rambam, all the typos, fixing things, being Nagia the Rambam, and he printed a beautiful edition of the Rambam. And shortly after that, someone else, a non-Jewish publisher, came along and published the Rambam again, but he charged a dollar less, or whatever, a gold coin less, whatever the currency was, for his edition of the Rambam. And I'm proud of him, putting all of his work into this, all of his effort into this, and now he wasn't going to make any money off of it. He was in big trouble. So he turned to the Rama and he asked the Rama to help him out if he can issue some sort of psak halacha. And the Rama sort of, it seems that he started a trend of sorts with this, because after this Rama, I mean, I'm not a historian, but it just seems to me just from knowledge of Svarim, after this Rama, you find that in Haskamas to Svarim, people start writing in Haskamas, and by the way, you're not allowed to publish this, and you're not allowed to take and steal the ideas from here and there. Right? There are certain Svarim where, why does it go along with the Haskamah? Because after I'm saying how great it is, so someone's going to say, oh, it's so great, so I'll publish it myself, and I'll sell it. So at the end of the Haskamah, after you say how great the Sefer is, some of the Haskamahs, you should read them. They don't always say how great the Sefer is. Sometimes it's, because there's a Sefer, I just saw him come and send it here the other day. It says, it has big letters on top, Divrei Bracha Mimoreinu Rabbeinu Hazon of Chaim Kanievsky Shlita. And it says in a little gray box in the middle, I went to Chaim Kanievsky and he said to me, Bracha V'Hatzlacha. If you go to Chaim Kanievsky, you'll know that Chaim Kanievsky, he doesn't have time to talk to you. You have to have an in to be able to talk to him. And he doesn't have time to talk to everybody he comes to. So what does he say? Bracha V'Hatzlacha. Bracha V'Hatzlacha. That's his phrase. That's what he says to everybody he comes to. This guy told me that Chaim Kanievsky is not a that's Haskama. You know, that's not the greatest Haskama. But in the old days, when people used to read books before they gave Haskama, rather, you saw it was a Vishnah, it was a Chaim Yivalashin, before he wrote that Haskama to Maitre Rav. And he read the entire Maitre Rav before he wrote his Haskama. He said, I read the whole book, it all looks good except for that point, and that's a Haskama. So it's eventually read the whole book. Right, and most of the time you see us coming nowadays, people haven't actually read the book. It's people have time to read the books, but it's a different style. But he used to do so for years and years. It seems to me, I could be wrong about this, if you check it out historically, after this Tshuva Sarama was printed, people started adding into their Haskamos, that they put a chayim on anybody who republishes the Sefer, and usually the chayim gave a period of time. For the next 20 years, anyone who republishes the Sefer is in the fame. The next 25 years, whatever it is, it always gave a period of time. So what was what did the Rama come out with? How was the Rama, in fact, make it in the end? So the Rama first goes through, the Rama became a famous tshuva because of the first half of the tshuva was completely chopped out, was because of the particular detail in this case, that it was a guy who published the other Rambam. So he dealt with the demon of the Ben Noach, and to what extent the Ben Noach is held accountable to our system of justice. Meaning that I'm not going to say, I can talk to him doing the faith. It's not going to help him, because Ben Noach, and he doesn't have to listen to him. So Rambam does recognize at the end that, that it's a Ben Noach who's involved in Jewish publishing. So to some extent he's going to have to listen to the Rambam, but he goes through what the demon of Ben Noach are. Then once he got through that, he goes into why he thinks that it's usher for this guy to publish his book, and why you have to buy the first edition of the Rambam that was published. So he writes that based on, first of all, this is why we had it in the earlier year, based on the issue of Hasagas Kavul, right? We know that the Gemara of Dasha Dachachachach Aleph tells us, Haibar Mavua, the Okime Chaya, if a person who lives in a neighborhood starts a mill and he charges people to use his mill, the Asa Bar Mavua Chavre, the Kamokim Gabe, and another guy wants to open up a mill across the street or in the same Mavui, so Dina Hudamakimale, he could stop him. So the Rama says, in Kain, our name is Fanenu, it's Mefurish in the Gemara, that based on our demon, based on Dina Torah, this guy has no right to go and open up his own set of Rambams, when the Seventh Rambam was just published. Second svara that Rama has to be made is the Gemara in Balbasa Daf Chav Beis, where the Gemara says that what happened was that Bimi Minhazah had brought some items to sell on a boat. So the Reish Kavusa said to Rava, go see if he's a Tzobim Rabbanim. Meaning this was Bimi was coming to visit. So the Reish Kavusa told Rava, see if this guy is coming to visit to sell stuff, to sell his wares, see if he's a Tzobim Rabbanim, see if he's a Tamil Chacham, and if he is, Nakut Leish Shuka. given the market. What does that mean, given the market? So Rashi in the Perush of the Gemara says, Nakalei Shukha, Hachrei, you have to publicize it. This guy coming to town, it's a Talmud Chacham, Shalo Yimkor Adam Grogos Be'ir, Ad Sheyimkor Mishalom. One of the zimim of a Talmud Chacham is you give him the right to sell out his produce first, and then you let other people open up their shop. No one's allowed to open up until he sells first. It's a zimim in the Talmud Chacham. The Rambam discusses this in the Perush of Shmaya and others, where the Rambam talks about how a person is not allowed to take money for their Talmud learning. The Rambam says, yeah, but that's all in terms of taking money and taking credit and taking kavod for your Talmud learning. That you can't do. But in terms of the chiyuv of everybody else to be mechaber the Talmud Chacham, so one of the zimim of kibbutz of the Talmud Chacham, of kavod that you have to give the Talmud Chacham is, let him sell his stuff first before the competitors sell theirs. So that's number two, says the Rambam. Clearly, the Maran Kadova is a Talmud Chacham, the other guy is a guy, not a Talmud Chacham, right? Not necessarily mutually exclusive, but he's a guy and he happens to not be such a great Talmud Chacham. And you have to let the Talmud Chacham sell his stuff first. The third reason he comes up with to be machmir over here is that you have to buy the more expensive set is a general halacha. And if you have two things of equal quality, and you have two stores that sell items of equal quality, and one of them is a Jewish store, one of them is not, so certainly you should frequent the Jewish store. Right? You should try to frequent, even if the person's not a Talmud Chacham, forgetting the Talmud Chacham thing, you should just anyway try to frequent the Jewish store. And then he quotes another Gemara. This was an unbelievable verse he points out. The Gemara says, too, so I remember when I was in YU, Rav Aaron Kahn gave a very fiery Musa Shmuz about why he thought television is a terrible thing to have in your house. And I remember he quoted the Gemara Tzuvah Tzvati Yitzet, and this Gemara was the whole basis for everything. But we're going to apply it to something other than television. The Gemara says that it's also the Hashem's Sefer Torah She'enu Muga Tov Peso Yosem Yishloshim Yom. If you have a Sefer Torah that's not really checked out for mistakes, and there could be some problems with the Sefer Torah, you're not allowed to leave it in your house for 30 days. You have to make sure it gets fixed or it gets put in Geneva. You can't leave it in your house for 30 days. Why not? Because you're going to leave from it and you'll misunderstand something, and you'll come to some sort of misunderstanding because the Sefer Torah wasn't correct. If they leave out the word low before the word sirsa, so you'll be reading Torah. Never knew that, right? You'll want to kill somebody. So it's not a good thing. It doesn't have to be such an extreme example, obviously, but it's not a good thing to leave the Sefer Torah Shein Amuga. The Gemara over there says that's why you're not allowed to leave a shtar parua until say so. Let's say a person paid me back money that he owed me, and I had a shtar that said he owed me money, and the idiot forgot to ask for a shtar back. So I still have the shtar. I still have it in my pocket. So I'm a good guy. I'm probably not going to get the money from him, but what if things get desperate, and I could really use the money? I have the shtar in my hand. I can always go and claim the money from him, and any basin is going to pop him like me because I still have the shtar in hand. So the Gemara says, don't even leave it in your house. You don't want such problems. You don't want it. And what if you die and your kids find it? And then they're going to go sue the guy. You don't want these things in your house. Just you get rid of these things completely. So Ron Khan was taking it that even if you have something that the etzem is really good, but if there's something that can come out of killful from it, okay, so you have a very beautiful Muslim shoe. And to this day, I don't have a television in my house. But the way that Ramah took it, Ramah says, you can't have a Sefer She'ed Amuga. If you have two smarter men, one of them worked out all the mistakes, and they took out all the typos, and they took out all the errors, and the other one didn't. So how can you buy the one that has all the typos and all the errors? You have to buy the one that's been corrected. You have to buy the one that's better off. And he quotes the Gemara that we quoted a couple of weeks ago on Shabbos in Parshas Zachar. The Gemara goes back and tells that amazing story about how Yoav went and he killed all the males of Amalek. And they said to him, what are you doing? You're killing all the males. You should have killed the females as well. He said, what do you mean? Timcha et Zachar Amalek. You're supposed to kill all the males of Amalek. He said, no, it's not Zachar, it's Zechar Amalek. What are you doing? Right? But the point is, the idea is, again, that whenever there's room for error, you try to avoid it as much as possible. So the Zachar, you can't really avoid because there are no Nekudos in the Torah. But, in a Sefer where there are typos, it says, it's not also to buy a Sefer that has typos in it if there is a better one available. You're not supposed to abide the sefer that was tabulated, which is kind of interesting. Lahalacha, I wonder what would the Ramah then say, not a republishing all the Gemara, they were completely new. They redid the whole page, basically, in recent years, and they redid all the Rashis, and they took out all the mistakes from them. They did all the Marshals were full, you know, tiny letters, and they expanded them, and they corrected every mistake in every type, or almost every one, and there are much better Gemaras now on the market than there were. But the Ramah say, it's also to buy an old printing of the Gemara, because it's also to leave a safer shade in Muga. Or do you get the idea maybe that Ramah was in the context of three other Heterim that he had, so he throws this on the list, but maybe this would not have been three other dozen to be Machmir, actually, so he threw this on the list, but maybe he wouldn't have used this as a sole reason to be Machmir. And then at the very end of the Shulchan Ramah says, I made him say, after all, this guy who was publishing the Rambam published a lot of very good Sfarim in the past, and he's helped the Jewish learning. He's done a belt for Jewish learning. So what are we going to do now? We're going to tell people they can't buy the Sefer. The guy never may decide never to publish another Jewish book again. And what's that going to do for Torah learning? So the Rambam says, I'm not worried about that. He says, first of all, the guy's not doing this for Shem Shemayim, he's doing it for money. And the same reason that he was publishing in the past for money, he'll publish again in the future for money. So you don't have to worry about the guy leaving the profession. You just have to do what's right. You can't take into the husband what the guy might be doing. So that was the first tshuva, the first major tshuva on the topic of stealing intellectual property. Because here was someone, it wasn't anybody's Rambam per se, meaning that it was the Rambam's Rambam, but the Rambam put a certain amount of work into it, someone else published right after that, so that was stealing from the publisher's rights to publish. The publisher had a certain right to sell it. It wasn't copyrighted. There was no Zina D'Malthusa in effect. It was just that this guy, the Talmud Chacham, had put in his work and had published it under his own, with his own effort. So it cost him money. Someone else were to go and to compete with him. So the Ramah felt that was enough of a reason to stop anyone else from publishing. And not everyone agreed with Ramah. I mean, the Marshal thought that it's only Gzeilah Midrabanan, and because it's only Gzeilah Midrabanan, maybe a guy isn't tied to Gzeilah Midrabanan. So the question then is, if you have a book that's published, that you're not allowed to go ahead and republish a book that has been published, what about small portions of the book? Right? The question Eli asked at the beginning, how do I hand out these Ramah comments? So you look at source number 11, which is one of the sources that I have to cut and paste, the Nishmat Avram, which is Dr. Abraham in Israel, Abraham, right? Avram, he was one of the foremost Talmidim of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, but he would ask a lot of Shailas more than just Rav Shlomo Zalman, he asked a lot of the contemporary Gedolim. So he poses the Shaila, in Mutum Tzali Ma'amarim, so the book is about Refuah, ostensibly. Mishmas Avram is a 6 or 7 volume sefer, and it's all supposed to be about Refuah. He's a famous doctor, it's not supposed to be about issues of halakha and medicine. Probably is, he can't really put 6 or 7, meaning he doesn't have say that the Shulchan Aruch. Not every halakha and Shulchan Aruch has something to do with Refuah in it. So he says, this is a good example of the type of thing that he'll do. Are you allowed to photocopy from a sefer or a medical book? There has to be Refuah in it. So if you are allowed to photocopy pieces of a sefer, Namar Rufuim or Taranim, right, whether they have to do with Rufuah or Torah, whatever it may be, Misefer or Ksav is L'shem Nimud V'shimush Atzmi, for your own personal use. Kishakashara Sefer or Ksav is Mafia Azhara, when it says in the opening flap of the sefer, She'ein Lahatik Olatalim Shum Chedek Me'atot L'lo Rishuk HaMachaber Amos La'ar. Right, so the copyright, you're not allowed to reproduce any piece of this book, the copyright specific, that's his old book, it says, or any piece of this book, without the express written consent permission of the author or the publisher. In the age of them, you together, so there's new together, let's say I'm going to a dinner or a cocktail or something, and I'm going to be sitting there bored out of my mind half the time, so I want to photocopy tomorrow's Daf Yomi, so I can prepare the Daf, because I want to, you know, to look at it at the Fasna. So is that going to be an issue for me to go ahead and to copy that page? I own the book, and I'm not, you know, it's not like I was going to buy another copy of the book. I got the one to photocopy so that it's easy to stick in my pocket, and I'll be able to carry it around. So is that us there? Us and Mishum Gezel, because the copyright says it's us there. I'll ask Shane Gezel to say Mishum, not doing it for any business purposes, or Revach Kasti, or for any financial gain. Oh, ha'im mutu la'atus kei Mishum Shalach Hasila mutu la'am ha'am yodea she'kafu na'am yodea. Or maybe you could say, this guy's not, the guy, the publisher knows what people do. The publisher realizes full well that this is the minute of Olam, that people make copies for themselves sometimes. And he knows, a little piece of the safer, you're going to photocopy for your own personal use. He's not going to be too bothered by it. He knows on his own there's going to be problems. I always thought for sure he knows that that's what people do. I thought every computer, the people who make the computer programs, know that if you have two computers, you put on both computers. Now I found out, because my one friend who actually called him and asked them, they know that they don't like it. And they sometimes they'll tell you not to do it. So to what extent do you have to listen to this? So he first says that he spoke to Rav Oldenburg, the Sitz Eliezer, where he wrote a letter to the Sitz Eliezer. And Sitz Eliezer wrote that for your own personal use, there's absolutely no problem doing this. Everyone knows you're going to use it. He likes the Svara very much. That the people for sure have given up in the first place on ever being able to use it to enforce such a rule, to control such a rule, such a law. And therefore, certainly, if you look in the second section of the photocopy in Source 11, it says, "Merely la halacha benido shelacha demar shemutzel esali ma'amarim rufuyin o tarani mechadome misefer oksav." You can ignore the copyright to that extent. Provided that you're copying it for personal use. Even though it says you're not even allowed to copy it for personal use, you're doing it for personal use, you can ignore the copyright.
From the library, here you own the book.
Right.
You go to the library and copy it.
So that's much more problematic. Meaning whenever it gets to a case where you might buy the book, so that's when we get into a real problem. Meaning it's an issue where I want that something. So A, if the book is not available, so then we're going to see, well, I don't know if we'll have a chance to get through the whole thing, or if the book is not available, so then there's a lot more reasons to be made. But if the book is available in the stores, and you're just being cheap, or you don't want to spend $20 on a book for one source, so that's really source number 12. We'll get that in a second. It relates to source number 12. And then he just points out that when it comes to preparing a shiur, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach held that it's mutter to do what we do here, to photocopy little pieces of the book, meaning Max Kabru said it better, meaning Rav Shlomo Zalman says, mutter to do it, because you're not doing it for business purposes, I'm just doing it to say a shiur. No one's planning on going out and buying my whole library, whatever sword I happen to have in my library, or the yeshiva that I teach and have in 7 days measures, or whatever I copy. It's fun. No one's going to buy it anyway. It just aids in the saying over of the Torah in the giving of the shiur. The Chavrusa pointed out that it's actually a better story when it deals with, it's certainly maybe not, so we don't hear also, not just with Talmidim, certainly, and in the shul as well. If there are certain svarim that sometimes you, if you use a sefer enough, you have to go to Eish Kodesh. The svarim that Rav Moshe Marburger uses, there are people that immediately go out and try to buy whatever svarim he uses, right? That is a difficult thing to do. But sometimes when you introduce someone to the sefer, they like the sefer. And then the only way to introduce them to the sefer is giving a photocopy and writing the sefer together. And when you learn the sefer, the person says, "This is good. I want that book." And they'll go out and they'll buy the book themselves. Right? But very often that actually encourages the advertising for them. Exactly, that even encourages. So I thought that was a very nice story. I like that story very much, especially since it helps. But I think it works. I think that it's very established. Beyond which some of them is just like you're only doing it personal use, not doing it to benefit monetarily. And the Sheikh Ralevi, Rav Vazna, was asked about a similar case where you're a teacher in a school, and the teacher in the school wants to quote cite from various different sources, and he wants the students to read an essay on this topic, an essay on that topic, and pulls essays from different books. So one chapter from 50 different books. There's no way the kids are going to buy 50 different books. Right? There's maybe some of the kids might buy one book or two. There's no way they're going to buy 50 different books. So is it mutter for the person to the teacher to go and copy it? So Rav Vazna writes in his tshuva, mutter, it's a mitzvah. the case was the teaching photo, right? So there's a mitzvah to go and copy and encourage Torah study. And the more you can encourage Torah study, the better it is. There's nothing to talk about. Certainly it's a great mitzvah to go ahead and to do it. But, you know, as always, there's always another side of the, there's always another opinion, right? The Tiskei Choshen, which is a flaw, the most thorough work on Choshen Mishpat, certainly the most thorough contemporary work on Choshen Mishpat that's out there on the market, the Tiskei Choshen, quotes all the earlier sources, and then he says, but, in Choshen 13, when he is writing near that, she in the silence could have a happy spin of Talmudim. If you're making photocopies, granted, not for money. Granted, you're making photocopies to give to the Talmudim. How is it close to Winkle? What's the difference between that and selling it? Meaning, well, you said, well, you're not making money. That's the difference. He says, am I not giving you a master's Winkle tumura kesef tumura kesef? What's the difference whether I'm making the copies so that I should gain money from it, or making the copies so I should gain the respect of my students, or making the copies so I should gain, you know, the attention of my students, or whatever it may be. Either way, I'm getting a personal gain from the photocopy of some paper that has a copyright on it that I'm not supposed to be copying. So he doesn't see why it should be any more mutter. He says, the only thing I see why it's more mutter is you're doing it for yourself. So you're giving it to students, so you're publishing it for other people. You're not allowed to do that, right? You can't copy someone else's safeguard and show it to other people and use it to distribute to other people. That's certainly not allowed, right? It's you take a movie and you make copies of the tape and you just give it to your friends. That's not permissible. That's a violation of copyright law, I'm sure. Right? To go in there and give it to your friends. You want to take something for yourself to watch it later. So fine. So maybe that's not a problem. But you want to, I don't know. But if you want to show it to other people, that's certainly problematic. Now there are a lot of things I didn't actually get to, but with 7 minutes left, the one thing that I really wanted to get to is to what extent do we have to follow copyright laws, and to what extent do we have to honor somebody else's intellectual property? Meaning, does halakha say, well, if there's a copyright law, there's a copyright law, otherwise forget it? Or does halakha say, no, there is some value to intellectual property? Because again, we don't have this idea of stealing something that is completely intangible. So I saw an essay, there are three pretty decent, some better than others, pretty good, but all of them pretty good English essays written on the topic of copyright laws that I know of. There's one from an RJJ journal from about 15 years ago, Rabbi Schneider, I think it was, is the person who wrote it, and if you Google copyright and halakha, you'll find this essay published on at least five different websites in different forms. So that's out there, that essay. Then there's another essay that was published by Rabbi Chaim Jachter in his Gray Matter Volume 1, just came out in Volume 2, for the collection of his essays, and where they both got all of their sources from. Rabbi Bleich in his Contemporary Halakha Problems has all of the sources, and he has the first discussion in English that I'm aware of on how the halakha views copyright. So basically, Rabbi Bleich gives all of these sources, and the Jackson put it in this format of five different reasons why copyright law should be binding. And there are nachtamina between the reasons, i.e. nachtamina might be, what if there is no copyright law? So he says, let's go through one at a time. First of all, the first source is the Sholem Aleichem. The Sholem Aleichem writes in the Tshuva that certainly the author who writes the book always maintains the rights to his work, and you're not allowed to go and take his work. And in terms of the publisher, he says, the publisher may be a chayav against, he says maybe the publisher may not have a right necessarily to protect it, a legal right, but the Sholem Aleichem says, you have to do that which is appropriate, and certainly if the Goyim can figure out that it makes sense to have copyright laws and not to steal somebody else's intellectual property, we should figure out the same thing. So it doesn't really give a good source, a strong source of why it does, other than that it's simply a din in menschlichkeit, that a person has to be a mensch and honor someone else's intellectual property. The Beis Yitzchak, which I believe is Rav Yitzchak Lachman, if I'm not mistaken. I know that I'm not 100%. But the Beis Yitzchak, which again I didn't have in the original, and it's not on the Bialowski game, I didn't want to go to the library and copy. But the Beis Yitzchak is quoted in the paper that I do have in the Tiskei Choshen, along with everything is quoted in the Tiskei Choshen. He was also asked, if you're allowed to reproduce Kiddushei Torah without the rishus of the Yarshim. Right? That's another, right, like we discussed, that's the big thing with the Soloveitchik family now, has big problems. See, everyone wants to reproduce the Rav's Kiddushei Torah, and not everyone gets permission or is interested in getting permission. Right? So the Beis Yisrael was asked this shayla. And the Beis Yisrael says that it's a very simple premise. He says he can't find anything in halakha that says that intellectual property, stealing intellectual property, is called stealing in any way. But what he does know, says the Beis Yisrael, is that there is a din of dinah d'malchus d'bimah. And the simple application of dinah d'malchus d'bimah will tell you that if there's a copyright on something, you can't use it. So let's say, taking the example of our salvation service, there's no copyright. And his Torahs, in general, and the reason why everyone else is publishing his Torahs is because he was a priesthood. He came from the Salvechik family, and the Salvechik, the line that they lived by was that not everything that you think should be saying, not everything you say should be right, and everything that you write should be published. So they ended up publishing nothing. Each of them published, you know, one book in their lifetime. You know, they worked their whole lives with making sure every word is, you could be in a Dayakin or a Chayim, like you could be in a Dayakin or a Rambam, like it's a Rishon. Because every word was read and reread, and they're so careful with what they publish. If you look at the Chidushei Agriz on the Rambam, you'll see a big difference between that and the Chidushei Agriz on Shas. Chidushei Agriz on Shas, every page says the same thing for 5 pages in a row, then it moves on to the next stuff. So there's no reason in it, because he never wanted to publish his own stuff. On the Rambam, that one book that he was willing to publish, it's precise, it's perfect, it's unbelievable. So that's what you have, people who didn't publish anything, so they didn't ever actually get a copyright on anything per se. So if it's all because of Dinah d'Malchus d'Bina, in the absence of copyright, you should have free reign to do as you please. That would be the Beit Yitzchak's approach. However, Mosbi Yehuda has a different approach. Mosbi Yehuda was dealt with a case where a guy had published a commentary on the Mishnah. And in publishing the commentary on the Mishnah, he reset the typeset of the Mishnayos themselves. So this person had just published the Mishnah with his own commentary on the side. And then the publisher said, once I did the typesetting on the Mishnah, so I'm not going to say without his permission republish, his commentary again and sell it off to someone else without giving him the money. But let me just publish a small Mishnah with this typesetting intact that I did for him, that the work was done for this guy who had written the commentary. So he published a set of Mishnahs, and he was selling that set of Mishnahs. So the guy who wrote the commentary said, what do you mean? How can you go ahead? You reset that typesetting for me. That was done for me. Right? So you can't go ahead and just sell it to somebody else. So you can write that this is a case of Zedna, the Zedchotzer. Some people are going to buy Mishnah. That means that if another set of Mishnah is available on the market, less people will buy the Mishnah as a commentary. The person is going to lose out. So yeah, you're being Zedna, the other guy's being Chotzer. You're not allowed to do that. So Zalman the Sidney Goldman, this quoted as having applied this to computer programs as well, right? That if you would need to buy the program, you can't survive with your computer not having Microsoft Word or whatever the program may be, so then it is that topic. It's not Zen or something. Even if there weren't a copyright, which there is, right? To go ahead and to use it, again, but probably one could argue that within your own house, using it on multiple computers, probably most computer programs, that would be in the category of what we said before, but the Tzitzel Yevon said about photocopying is safer for your own personal use. I mean, my computer crashes and I lose disks all the time. I just want to have it backed up. I want it somewhere. I want to be able to use it within my own house, and it's more convenient for me to be able to switch it back to my laptop and my desktop. So that could be, so as long as it's still my own personal use, and it's not a problem. But otherwise, and it would be a problem for that reason. The fourth reason why it might be a problem is the Chassidus points out in the context of Hasagas Gevul. Someone invests a lot of money and time and effort into being able to make a parnasa off of something, you can't go in and take away, rob the person's parnasa. Now, this shiur, in the series of shiur that we gave, we discussed each of these topics individually. It would be interesting to go back and say, well, wait a second, dinah d'malchus d'bina, does that really always apply? There's some shiur that only applies to taxes, there's some shiur that doesn't apply in Eretz Yisrael. So you have a lot to work with. I mean, there's room to argue with each discussion. I said this before, there are very specific guidelines as well when we apply a Sadat Kavol. But at least in the eyes of these postkins, of each of these individual postkins, this is a proper application of this concept. And the final concept is what I found to be a fascinating one, is Rav Zalman Lechani Goldberg, who's Shlomo Zalman Rebbe's son-in-law, Right. And we do have a concept, and I'm sure there's such a concept in the American legal system as well, that when I sell something, I don't always sell 100% of that item. Meaning, I might sell something and still withhold some of the rights of that item. For instance, the law doesn't say it says I can sell a sheep, but I maintain the right to future production that the sheep is going to make, to the wool that the sheep is going to make. So, just because I'm selling the goof hashif doesn't mean that I'm giving you all of the rights along with it. So when a company sells you something, they sell you a computer program, they sell you a CD, they're selling you the rights to use that CD for your enjoyment, to use that program for your own personal, but they don't give you the right to go ahead and to use it in whatever context you would like. Just, we'll close the share with, ooh, I'm sorry, we're over time. Let's stop the share.
Ahora con esta terra